Okay, so last time we. Oh, actually, at the end of the notes, there's the set of exercises. And so that would be the first assignment. And there are. So the aim is to get 10 points. How you get those 10 points is up to you. I'll give results and solutions to all of them so that then it's a better way of learning. So even if you don't do exercises, you can still learn from them by seeing the solutions. But at least you can attempt them. We don't have to hand them in if you're not sure. If you want to do the easy ones instead of difficult ones, it's up to you. Okay, so last time we started a little bit briefly. Huh? Are you ready now? Okay, so last time we very briefly started talking about category theory, and I mentioned, and I'll specify a bit more what this means later, but I mentioned that in order to do category theory, one tries to switch from an external, sorry, from an internal perspective to an external perspective. So the internal perspective is normally what you use in set theory, in the sense that the things that you describe are according to properties the elements of a set has. In category theory, instead, everything you describe is in terms of relations. This is a more relational type of maths. And then last time I explained what a generalized map was. So I'm not going to rewrite it again, but we basically said that what a generalized map is between two objects that don't have to be sets, right? And this map was defined according to certain properties it had, not on how it acted on the individual elements. So now we'll start from the a concept of an equation in category theory. Now, I put it in inverted commas. It's not a precise definition of what an equation is, really, but it's just a conceptual analog of what an equation is in sets. So, normally in set theory, you have, well, this is something, those two things. This is an equation, and the objects here are normally elements. Now, instead, in a general category, this concept of an equation is given by what you call a commuting diagram. Okay, now it will become clearer as we go on, but for now, let's first define what a diagram is. I'm sure you, we kind of saw it a little. Do you put a Y? This is right So what is a diagram? So the formal definition is an indexed or labeled graph. So it has the following. It has a collection of vertices. So, which in a non-labeled graph, you just have vertices, right? In a labeled one, the vertices are labeled by objects. And then you have a collection of oriented edges. So oriented means if you have a source and a target, the orientation is source target. Obviously, that's just a graph, but a diagram has labeling, so which are labeled by maps. This was a diagram is. So, for example, this is a diagram. Oh, this is a diagram. Okay, so it's a collection of objects and of arrows. Now, the fact that it commutes means that if you go this way or this way, you get the same result. Or if you go like this or like this, you get the same result. So commuting means the following. First efforts. Or in this case, it would mean that J is equal to. So the first one, and then you compose it with the second. And this generally is what you do instead of equations in category theory when you reason about things. So you have objects, and when you prove theorems, you normally try and find commuting diagrams. And as you see here, the relations are between arrows. In sets, so you have relations between elements. In categories, the objects are kind of secondary. I mean, relations here are redefined in terms of functions. The objects are kind of important, but they basically tell you how maps compose. In that sense, they're secondary to objects and sets. So in sets, the objects are important things, and the relations are relations between sets. Sorry, objects. In category theory, the important things are the arrows. Now, care should be taken when you define commuting diagrams, because if you have something like this, right, and you say this commutes, what you're saying is that this is equal to, yes, this. But what you're not saying is this, right? These are not the same. So that's important. So commutation, because obviously this, if you had sets and you say that for each element does that, then you would get this. But we're not in sets, right? We're in category. So all that this means is that. In special cases, you have this, but those are special cases. But generally, you just get this. Let's go here. Okay, so once we define diagrams and arrows, let's try and understand precisely what I mean by this change in perspective. So I said that in set theory, you describe things internally. In a categorical language, you define things externally. In order to really understand what that means, we'll take some examples and describe them both internally and externally. Now, this we can do only if the examples that you consider, well, okay, the most, not only, but it's just easier to consider it in sets. Now, sets, it's obviously sets, but is also a category, so it admits an internal and external description. And this is what we're going to do. So we're going to describe the same elements both internally and externally. And here we're in sets, yes? If you're not here, then this wouldn't really count. In sets. You can take the notes. So, for example, let's take the concept of an element. Okay. Now, internally, let's say you have a set S. What is an element? Well, you specify some properties of the elements, and you say that that element belongs to S. Now, this belonging relation obviously requires that you have a notion of individual elements. Now, if you don't want to use the notion of individual elements, so you can't use the belonging relation, what do you do? Well, you do the following. So remember that you need to define everything in terms of relations between two objects. So one object is obviously the object of which you want to define an element. And the other object will be this thing here. Now, this is a set, so we're in sets. So you can consider all possible sets that you want. So this is a set, and is a set that contains only one element. It's called a singleton. Now, an object in an external perspective is defined as a map from the singleton to sets. Now, since we are in set, you can actually define this map. You can really apply it, right? So you have this. Now, since there's only one object, this F only gets one element here, right? So it will be an element A. Let's call it small a. Which, oh no, X. Sorry. Actually, let's call this A. The same one, right? So we'll pick one element. Now imagine you want to pick another element. Then what you do, you can't use this one because that's done. So you just get another function which identifies your other element. And so on and so forth. So you have to each element, you can assign a map. Now, the important thing is that this description is allowed because we're in sets. But the concept of an element is simply this, is a map from your singleton to your set. That's all it is. That's an element. Then what about a subset? So internally, a subset, you define it in terms of a certain property which the element of this subset satisfies. So you single out a subset according to a communal property that they all share. That's an internal description. Now externally, how do you do? What do you do? So again, you need to define a relation in terms of maps. And this is defined as follows. So first I write, then I explain. So a subset is defined in terms of a map, which in set is just a characteristic function. But generally, it's, well, it's an equivalent. But anyway, it's a map from your set to a particular object, which is called the truth object. But for now, it's just a set with two elements, which can be interpreted as true or false. So why does this represent this? So let's draw something. So we have our S, and this is our A. So again, this makes sense because when set, so this is the translation. So what this characteristic map does, it gives you value 1 to the elements that do belong to A, and value 0 to the ones that don't. So it singles out this subset by telling you this, yes, that elements belong to a subset. So as you can see, there is a one-to-one correspondence between each subobject and its characteristic function. So what this does, it identifies an element according, sorry, a subset according to the elements that belong to it. And then like this, you can translate back to the internal perspective. However, externally, you can only go that far. So a subset is a map from your object to a truth value object, which in set is this, but in a general topos is not that. It's much more complicated. Okay, so then the last thing, what about the equations? Let's do some equations. So what about, for example, associativity? So externally, you have a set S, and you want to define the associativity property. And you say that for any triplet of elements, the following holds. Again, internal, right? You specify the elements, and then for each of these elements, you specify an equation that this element satisfies. Now you got those. Now we want to define an analog of this. Now, I said at the start that when you have equations, you're looking for commuting diagrams. So you need to find a commuting diagram which abstractly tells you this property. And it's the following. Can I delete this? Okay. So first I write, then I explain. Huh? So the commuting diagram is this. So you say that the propped associativity is requiring that this diagram commutes. Okay, so what are the individual elements? So we have this new arrow. What is this? So this arrow is the product arrow, so to say. So it takes two elements and associate a single element. Now in set, you can use the individual components. In this case, you simply have this. And this is just the identity. So it doesn't do much. Okay. So now let's see how you can recover this by the condition that this diagram commutes. So you get here, you get ABC. So this tells you that to the first one, you apply the identity, so you leave it as it is. To this two, you apply the multiplication. So you multiply, B and C, sorry. Now then what this tells you is that now you multiply this two. This is already multiplied, so you end up with something like this. Now you go this other way. This tells you that now you first multiply this 2, and you get this, and the third stays the same. And now this tells you to multiply those 3. Now, because you require this commutes, the result is the same. And you get this. But this obviously is an abstract characterization of this individual equation. So it's like, I don't know if you did differential geometry, but it's a bit the same thing as, you know, in differential geometry, you can define things abstractly, or you can choose a specific coordinate reference frame and then embed it. It's kind of the same thing. This is the abstract, and this is the kind of coordinate reference frame. Okay, so now another thing that is useful is, again, between this external and internal perspective, is to define the group operations externally. So those were some examples. Now, you can also define group operations both internally and externally. And I think that's also very useful to know. The definition of groups. Well, group laws rather than operations, sorry. So what are the group laws? Well, associativity is just that. Okay? Just that one. Now, the other one is the inverse element. Okay, let me get it right. It's one of them is the exercise. I don't remember which one I gave you to the deck. I'll just give you the result. Yeah, that's right. The inverse element. So what in standard definition of group theory, the inverse element is that for each element you have its inverse such that this is satisfied. Again, what we're trying to do is define a commuting diagram which tells you this. Again, which is valid for all group elements. So what is this diagram? Maybe I could actually fit it here. So this diagram is the following. So I first write, then I describe. Okay, so now we have some new arrows, which I have to describe. Okay, so what are those new arrows? So we have the diagonal map, which gets an object and it duplicates it. So again, because we're still in both internal and external, you can actually define it component-wise. This just gives you this. The identity we know. Now we have the I. The I is the inverse map. So to each element, it assigns its inverse. And then we have the unit map, which is the constant map. So it's not the identity, it's the constant map. So to each element, it assigns the same value, basically assigns the identity.
In the diagram, have you written the right thing there? G going to be G cross G going down? Should that really be I dot cross identity to the left?
This one.
That.
Oops, sorry. No, this is. This, I'm missing one. Mm-mm. So, okay. So here it's. No, that was right, actually. Yeah, sorry. So, yeah, thank you. That's good, yeah, good. So, yeah, thank you. Okay, so now, this, given this definition, we want to reproduce this equation here. And again, you go all the possible ways around this diagram. So that equation is equivalent to saying that this diagram commutes. So you start with one. Here you just get the same copies. Then the first one, you leave it as it is. And the second, you apply the inverse. And then you multiply the two. And you go this other way. So first you get two copies, then now the first one you get the inverse, the second one stays the same, and then you multiply this two, and because you require that this diagram commutes, you require this to be equal, and that's equal just as going this way, which is just to G, just gives you the identity. So this, again, is the external categorical way of this equation. Okay, and the exercise is to define the unit. I mean, obviously, the unit, the identity element is that, but then you have to show that this is the case. That's obvious. Okay, so now that I've tried and explained the internal external perspective, we can finally define what the category is. It is really not very difficult. I mean, the important thing is really how to reason. That is what's important, that you have to really change your way of thinking of things. The definition of a category is quite easy, really. So, okay, what's a category? So a category is composed of one, a collection of objects which let's call this category C. And the collection of objects is denoted as follows. Then for any two objects, there exists a set of maps or morphisms between those two objects. So this is just basic all maps from A to B. Now, obviously, depending on this category, this set can be empty. You can have one element, and it can have, I don't know, infinite amount of elements. But for each, you can define this set. If it's empty, then it's empty. And this maps here undergo certain properties, which I already said before, basically composition. Them as long as the codomain of F is equal to the domain of G. So this codomain of F has to be equal to the domain of G. Then these maps have to be associative. Okay. So assuming that they satisfy the right codomain-domain relations, then these two things are equal. And okay, I think this we saw in last lecture. And then the third is the unit element. So each object has to have a map from that object to itself. And that's a basic axiomatic definition of what a category is. Not very difficult. Okay, so for example, this thing here is a category. It's got three objects and two maps and then the identity maps. This is a category. So you see this thing has only the identity maps. It's still a category. Just doesn't have, it's just that this set's empty for A and B distinct. But it has to have the identity maps. A bit more, kind of more complicated example of a map of a of a category. It's a poset, and the reason I mention it is also because when we will define quantum theory in terms of a topos, we will use the concept of a poset. So what's a poset? So it's a category. So it's a set. So a set is a category which has a partial ordering. Denoted like this. So partial means that it's not the case that every two elements are ordered. For example, this. It's true that these guys have a relation, but these don't. So that's a partial ordering. And so it's a binary relation, and it satisfies certain properties. One is that it's reflexive. So each object is related to itself. It has to be transitive, which is basic composition of arrows. So if this is the case, and this is the case, then this is the case. And it has to be anti-symmetric, I think. so that if this is the case, and then these two are the same. Obviously, if it was totally ordered, then either or had to always be the case. But this is only if. Not that that's the case. That's a partial ordering. Okay, now another important thing to mention is the, in category theory, is the, maybe I should list that also. So I think in the notes there are various examples, but just to mention a few that you normally use, actually one is important, that you normally use in physics without thinking that is a category is the following. For example, the category top, which is the category, which has as objects all topological spaces. And as maps, continuous maps. I mean, this is all examples of categories that you use in physics. It's just that I don't think you ever think of them as being category. I mean, you never consider them all together, all possible topological space with continuous map. You do consider single ones of them, but you never see them as a category. Another one, for example, vector spaces. So, say over R. So you've got vector spaces and then linear maps. Another one is, for example, the natural numbers. This is quite interesting. So the natural numbers, seen as a category, you can consider as an object only them. Now the maps are basically the only maps that exist, since it's an object with one category. The only maps you can have are these guys. And each map represents a number. So that, and what this tells is that then you can combine all of them. Right? So number M is from, et cetera, et cetera. So what this means is that if here you have M, N, this is M plus N. And okay, then the others, I think the lecture knows the other ones. But so there's an example where there's only one element, but an infinite amount of maps. And again, the information is in the maps. The element is just the same. But here it's quite clear how the important things now are the maps. Okay. Is it clear so far? So now one, again, this I'll mention because we will use it a lot when then defining Tobol's theory in terms of, quantum theory in terms of Tobol's theory. But for now, I'll just mention it. So this is the principle of duality. So imagine you have a category. And this category, from the definition, has collections of objects, and it has morphisms. So relations between this, or for any pair, it has relations. And this is all possible maps within that category that go from A to B. Now this category can be dualized. So you dualize it. And you obtain a dual category, which is denoted as follows. And it has as objects exactly the same objects. Nothing happens to the objects, just that now they're viewed as belonging to a different category, but they're exactly the same. What happens is something here. So what happens is that now the morphism of, again, these two objects now go the other way around. They twist. So now a map is seen as a map from B to A. Now, the importance of this is that you can do this for pretty much anything. And the result is that then you get this dual principle. Which is good in proving things. Right. And so what this tells you is if a statement, whatever that might be, but if a statement or a theorem is true in a category, then the opposite of that statement, or the dual version, is true in the opposite category. So this basically gives you things for free, right? So if you're in a category and you find you want to prove something and it's a little bit difficult, you dualize and it might be true that the dual is much easier. And once you know that this is true, then you get for free the fact that the dual statement is true in the other category. So for example, well, I'm not going to prove any statement, but just a category R, okay, this is kind of true. The dual is, I think this is an exercise. Anyway, the dual is this guy. Okay, in this case, I can't think of anything that's not provable here, but provable there. But in general, it can be the case that using the dual might be easier in proving some things. And we will use that later and when we define topos theory, quantum theory in terms of topos theory. Okay. So now that I've described what a category is, I'll describe certain properties of special maps. So we've seen that in category theory, the importance is the relations. So the important things are maps between objects. So there are some maps that are of a special kind and which then will represent important things. So what are these maps? So let's call it maps in a category. And these important types of maps are the following. The first one is what you call a monic map or monic arrow. Now this is important because then eventually it will give you the notion of inclusion or of a subgroup. But for now, we'll just call it monic. And what a monic arrow is the following. So F is monic, if given another pair of functions, so this always such that then it is true in this specific case that these two are equal. So it's only for monic arrows that this is true. We've seen before that if that is true, it does not imply this. But if this is monic, then it implies this. So another way of saying that an arrow is monic is if it is left cancelable. Now, if you had to translate the concept of a monic arrow in set theory, this would be equivalent to requiring that this map is injective. So, I don't know, you probably all know what it is, but what this means is that, so F is injective if this equality implies that these two guys are the same. this isn't set. The categorical analog of this is requiring that this is left cancelable. Now, why is that? So we want to show that, so remember that in set theory, you can have both internal and external, right? So in set theory, it makes sense to say the following, that F is monic if and only if it is injective. This is okay in sets. Huh? If you're not in set, this word is meaningless. In set, this thing has meaning, because you can define both. Okay, so that is what we're trying to, I don't know if it's a theorem, it's probably not a theorem, but. So what's the proof? So you have to go two ways, right? So first you have to show that if F is monic, then it is injective. And you have to go the other way around. If F is injective, you have to show that it's monic. So let's say that F is injective. So you have that. Oops. Then assume that there exists two maps. F is always from A to B. Well, let's write it down. So there exist two maps, such that it is the case that the diagram which they form together commutes. So it is the case that this is true. Now what we need to show is that eventually you get that G is equal to H. Okay, so now since we're in set, you can actually apply this map. So you get an element of C and you apply them. Yep. And you get to this. Now, since F is injective, you just apply this definition and it follows that and since this is valid for all, and this implies, okay, and so you prove that this is a monic. Now you can go the other way around. Actually, I'm going to. Read it. Sorry, this thing is. Right, so that was one way of the proof. The other one is that if, which one did we do? If F is monic, then F is injective. So we assume that if this is the case, then these two are the same. Now the proof requires a very special case, but it shows you that inevitably it is this is true. So the proof goes as follows. Imagine that H is just a one element set. It just has zero element. So this is C. Then you assume that A, so this is H and this is G. and it gives you x and y, which you have to prove that they're the same, but you don't know yet. And then this maps to the same element. So this is your setting. So you do know that these two are the same. In order to show there's injective, you have to, from this property, you have to show that this is the case. Okay, so now the situation you have that h0 is equal to x and is equal to y. And then from this condition, you have that f of h of 0 is equal to f, I wrote the same, sorry. Okay, so h, g. So this one, and f of y is f of g of 0. And from this condition, these two are the same. Now, because this is left cancelable, from here you show that h of 0 is equal to g of 0. And this is true for all elements. There's only one element. Yeah, I did it. All right, sorry. Okay, ends up, yeah, you show this. And this is for monics. Now, there is since a monic represents an injective function, there's obviously a categorical analog of a surjective function and and bijective function. So what's a surjective function? The categorical analog of a surjective function is the notion of an epoch map. So f is epoch if given other maps. So f is always from A to B. So given other maps, now this time from B to C, such that G of F is equal to H of F, then G is equal to H. So this time an epoch map is left cancelable. So this is equivalent to saying that is, right cancelable. And in sets, you can show that if F is epoch, then both ways really, F is a surjection. Surjection, just probably all know it, but. And a surjection means that, for all elements in B, so this is the definition of surjection. So for elements in B, there exists an element in A such that F of A is equal to B. This is surjection. And you can show that, you can show this. That's an exercise down on it. And then the last. Is the concept of, so we have injective, surjective, of the categorical analog of a bijection function, and it's called an ESO. f. So f is, again, I keep forgetting to write, f is a to b. So if there exists a map from b to a such that g, so obviously this is the inverse, yeah. Now in the notes you I proved that this map has the following properties. First of all, that G is unique. No, I won't prove it. Then the second, I don't remember, one of them is an exercise, I don't remember which one. The second is that if F is an ESO, then F is monic. If F is an ESO, then F is epic. But it's not always the case that if F is monic and epic, it is necessarily an ESO. Oh.
No, that's weird, because in set theory, you have the theorem that if something has an inverse, then it's always injective and surjective, whereas those two are equivalent, but they're not in categories.
No, in general. In sets also, in sets they would be the same in general. In a general, okay, yeah, sorry. I'm not sure if it's worth starting something else. Okay, maybe another definition. I'm sorry that there's a lot of definitions, but it's just how it is. So those are some special arrows. So what about some special elements? We do actually have some special elements. And these are two of them particular importance. One is the terminal object. I always confuse the two. That's that one. Okay. So in a category C, a terminal object is obviously an object which you denote it by 1, and such that for any other object there exists one and only one map from A to that object. That's the characteristic of a terminal object. Now, we've already seen what the terminal object is in sets, and it was this guy here. It's a singleton. And you can show that that is the case. And the terminal object is important because, if you remember, this identified elements. So in category theorem, element is basically of any object is a map from the terminal object to whatever objects you're considering. So, yeah. So element is this as an element. In set, it was just the singleton, but in general, that's as far as you can go. And then this is the last definition, initial object. So it's an object in C denoted. Such that for all other objects, it's like the dual of this, then there exists only one map. From to your object as the definition of a term object. In sets is the empty set. And I think I'll stop here with the definitions. But I don't know, it's a kind of coming across how you start thinking category theory, this internal, external picture. And so, I mean, an element here is just literally this. This is as much as you can say. You can't really say anything else for an element. In sets, obviously, you can say much more. But okay, I think I'll stop here.
Practical question, when do you want the homeworks?
It's Friday. And oh, actually, so this is the first time I go to the course. So if it's too difficult, if it's still a little time or whatever, just let me know. Because I'm still gauging the thing. But yeah, I said that you can choose, I don't know if you were here when I said that. So you can, the mark is 10, so you can choose how to make it 10. But when I give this the solution sheets, I will give solutions to all so that you see. I mean, it's a good way of learning, right, so you can see.
Can I ask a question about
sure.
the duality principle?
Sure.
When you construct dual category, it's not really that you have each arrow, you reverse the orientation.
Mm-hmm.
Is that like that? Because in sets, for instance, you may have, for instance, when you have an arrow that goes to the terminal object, there's only one. But if you reverse the orientation, you have, well, as many arrows as elements in the
mm-hmm.
in the object, so you have several opposite categories.
Yeah, okay, these are dual, so you would end up with a terminal object and one is the initial object of that one.
So you don't actually pick a specific arrow and try to construct an arrow.
Generally, yes, apart from, okay, in this specific case, but if you had So for the example, when you have this guy, the dual is literally this. So in this case, you reverse everything, okay, with the terminal initial being defined dually. So, okay, maybe I should have said, there are certain notions that are dual to each other, for example, this one. But in general, you would...
Epic and monic as well.
Yes, okay, sorry. You don't just... Epic and monic would be dual, initial terminal would be dual. Let me think of others. Product and disjoint union. I think I wrote in that, but yeah. Yeah, thanks.
Just wondering, it's a Greek word for ISO. I mean, monic and epic are so wonderful Greek word. ISO is sort of.
This is Greek, right?
Yeah, it's a syllable, but it's not.
It doesn't have the same stage
it's
or
so. It's not as epic as epic.
Yes, yeah.